I have chosen as the setting for our study the Psalms. And we have been working with the Psalms last week. We'll be working with the Psalms again this week. I'd like to just ask, though, who was with me last week? Can you put your hands up, please? Let me see. Two, three, so on. Okay. No, it's going to determine a little bit how I'm going to approach this today, because I, with your permission, without your permission, I'm going to just give a little of the background that we worked out of last week, but I am going to approach different Psalms, so it'll be hopefully worth your while to hang in there. By the way, we said we're going to do Psalm 23 today. We're not. Last night I had a revelation from the Lord. No. I had a change in plans. But I'd like to feel the Lord had something to do with it. But at any rate, and I think those that were with me last week will understand why I'm shifting a little bit. And we are going to do Psalm 23 this week, but we're going to do it by the end of the week. And there's reasons for that. And those who were with me last week, out of the structure that we were working, I think they say, yeah, I understand. Why? I just say that because Psalm 23 is such a precious psalm of our, comes out of our piety, that I don't want you to think that I... And you'll see why we're doing what we're doing this week. We're going to be working on Psalm 8 and 33 today, or 33 and Psalm 8, and you'll see why there was a little bit of a shift. And the reason is that last week, you grow a little bit as I have unfolded the Psalms, and therefore we can make a few changes. What I want to do in the introduction, and again, this is some I shared last week, and I say this for the three or four that were here with us, but maybe it doesn't hurt just to go through some of this again, or it just leaves parts of it, and I hope it's we'll do it rather quickly. You know, when we think of the Psalms, I think every one of us have a few sets, you know, a few Psalms that we think about, like Psalm 23, you know. But I don't know of too many of us who really take the book of Psalms seriously in the sense that we use all the Psalms. And I would suggest that unless we can take all the Psalms seriously and really take the totality of this prayer book with all of its facets, we really don't do justice to any one Psalm, including Psalm 23. In other words, I think we can't isolate the prayers into just, let's say, those that we just feel comfortable with, because as we get into the Psalms, we're forced not only to get into all of the seasons of life, we'll talk about that, but we, by the way, there's more chairs in the other room, and there's more space back here, and so you have to sort of, there's this homey ways of doing things, and there's one chair over here, and back in here, just come around here and bring the chairs around. On that side. Not only does it force us in the seasons of life that we're familiar with, but also it forces us to take seriously the character of God. If you want to come on this side, come on over here. And if you feel more comfortable. Go ahead.
Right.
So we'll just look at you. We'll
just have to come all the way around.
Yeah, just look at you. What's your name?
My name is Donna.
Donna, why are you interrupting the class? By
for once in my life, I have a good excuse. I wash tables.
Oh, Donna, glad to have you. Because it's going to force us also into a fresh way of taking a look at God. And I think I can say that with those that were here last week. You know, all of a sudden we're going to confront God in new and fresh ways, and very uncomfortable ways sometimes. Because we got to begin to think like a Hebrew. But I hope it will open up our vision of God and our relationship with God, and also can influence our prayer life, etc. The Psalms, by the way, as such, are songs, are human responses to God's action in our lives and God's word in our lives. And it's not just in the book of Psalms. There are other places where there are Psalms in the Bible, and you would think of the Psalm of Miriam or the Psalm of Moses, to whomever you want to credit that. Exodus 15, Exodus, you know, the Red Sea incident. And you have there, just go back there in Exodus 15, you have the Song of Moses or the Song of Miriam.
And this, you have the song or the psalm of Deborah, one of the judges. And it, we said last time, it's interesting, you read her psalm, I think it's the song of Deborah's Judges 5, and you find that that is a poetic interpretation of the event, which is discussed in chapter 4, narrative style. And you'll find some differences. I don't want to go into that, but it's an interesting thing. And in all probability, and almost conclusively, the song actually came, at least chronologically, earlier than the writing of the narrative. It says something about the songs of the Psalms coming out of the experiences of people. You have this song of Hannah, remember? Yes. In the first Samuel chapter 2, after Samuel is born, remember that one? Which becomes the basis of the Song of Mary, the Magnificat. These are psalms. And we'll see later on, like the prophet Jeremiah, there's many psalms of lament. Many psalms of lament. And so the psalms, you know, these kind of prayer songs, are not just within the book of Psalms. They are throughout, we find them throughout the scriptures. But certainly the book of Psalms, those 150 as we know it, become the prayer book, which is not only the prayer book of the Hebrew people, they were the prayer book of our Lord, the prayer book of Jesus, which is something we're going to have to address and talk about, and also become the liturgy source, let's say, for the early church, and certainly with the influential prayer book of the believing community down through the centuries. If any book, the prayer book. And it reflects, again, not only the faith concepts, both of God and of the, but as well as it reflects every season of human experience. And that's why we can identify, perhaps, with the Psalms. The Psalms, as we'll find out somewhere this week, are not only the psalms of praise, there's actually more psalms of lament than there are psalms of praise, which says something about the reality, let's say, the realism of the psalmist as they address life. Okay, it doesn't, the high, you know, the high ground, there's a lot of valley experiences, rough experiences, which evoke every kind of human emotion. And you will find every kind of human emotion in the Psalms, unabashed. Which says something about honesty in prayer, but also says something about the relationship between the believer and Yahweh. The Psalms are poetry. This is repetitious a little bit, but last time I wasn't. I said it rather accidentally, and I found out a lot of people sort of appreciated it, and it came up today in the in our song class at 4:30. When we talk about Hebrew poetry, very simple. I don't want to get in. We're not going to get into so much, you know, the structure of the Psalms per se, or the history of the Psalms per se, how they all came, and so on. I'm more interested in the theology of the Psalms, or let's say, how it comes out of our life experiences. That's more where we're at. But nevertheless, some of this sometimes is helpful. And so Hebrew poetry basically is parallelism, or a rhythm of sense. That's why they could dance to the Psalms. And Paul last night, Paul Ross was one of the dancers to the Psalms, because there is a rhythm, and there's a rhythm of sense, and it can be expressed not only in song, it can be expressed also in dance. And you have this thing of parallelism. I'll just put this up here now. I don't know about other teachers. I cannot write on a board and walk at the same time. But again, I can't walk on a curb and chew gum either. You know, Psalm 2:1, for example. Now, I want you to look at the parallelism. Why do the nations conspire and the people plot in vain? You find there's a parallelism here. Why do the nations conspire? Why do the people plot in vain? Psalm 2, by the way, is going to be the psalm we're going to talk about tomorrow. But there's a parallelism there. And you also find there's an antithetic parallelism. For example, the second part opposed to the first, and the parts are called stitches for some reason, S-T-I-C-H, of the psalm. And, for example, in Psalm 1, which is a familiar psalm to us, it says, "For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish." There's an antithesis there. But it's a parallelism. They say it one way, and they say the opposite the other way. Another example, you have synthetic parallelism. Synthetic, of course, means that there's something complementary there.
And another psalm, like Psalm 95. For the Lord is a great God, a great King above all gods. And we find that that it develops the thought. It develops the thought. But this thing of parallelism, I think we'll note that in the Psalms. We'll note that in the Psalms. And it's done where there's a rhythm that's given, a rhythm of sense, a rhythm of sense. And that's what makes the Psalms Hebrew poetry. By the way, like last week, I encouraged the class to write Psalms, and some did read them. I'm laughing because of the first time that came in with a creative psalm. It blew our minds. But you're encouraged. If somebody says, hey, I want to write a psalm, write a psalm and share it in class. And I encourage you to do anything. Last week, somebody went and did some research on the Psalms and came back and shared it and so forth. This is your class, and you put into it, you know, what you want to. And you may have some fun, you know, in getting into the Psalms, especially some of your favorite Psalms. Again, when we're talking about Hebrew prayer life or Hebrew Psalms, it isn't so much up here. You know, we are very, Western people are very Greek-orientated in their thinking, and therefore we operate very much in a cerebral fashion, very much so. Where in Hebrew, they operate out of the gut. They always talk about the bowels. You know, we don't say that anymore because it's not polite. Hebrew didn't care if it was polite, it's out of the bowels, but you know that's where it is. We always say it's out of the heart. We get a pain up here, we're frightened. But most of the time when we are upset, it's down here. That's right. It's right here in our gut. It's a good place to say it. And that's where a lot of the expression that comes out of the Hebrew poetry. And Hebrews are very concrete in their conceptualizations, where we tend to be very abstract. You know. Like, for example, I'll give you an example. We would say, the omnipotent one in his divine providence will not permit his creation to miscarry. Now that's a typical Greek way of saying it. The Hebrew will say, the Lord is my shepherd. You see, we have different concepts. You know, God is omnipotent, omnipresent. You know, we got that all in the catechism. It's all Greek thought. But the Hebrew thought is far more concrete. And I think there's something refreshing about that. And 20th century people, we who are so filled in a technological age, you know, and with our big success orient, you know, driving that makes us what we are. We're talking about that this morning. Very materialistic culture. I think that we find refreshing to be forced back into the kind of thinking that comes out of Hebrew poetry and the Psalms. Therefore, I feel they have a way of addressing us and maybe sobering us up in our age, especially as the believing community, because we can be swallowed up by our own age. We'll talk more about that as time goes on. The Psalms, by the way, are meant to be sung, not just spoken. They're meant to be sung. Last night we sung a psalm. Because it'd be done in a communal way, even though a lot of the Psalms have eyes, you know, individual. They actually become a community, part of a liturgical life. Liturgical life means the life of worship of the people of God. And very much way, that's the way they are experienced. And we'll sense some of that too as we study the Psalms. They're to be sung or danced to. They're an expression. They're not just something to be read in private. We often use our Psalms for private meditation. The Hebrew, we use them for public worship, and they're a sung. They're that kind of a feeling that comes in to the Psalms. Another thing, I'm rattling on fast today, but hang in here with it. To get back, the basis of Israel's prayer life also is covenant. Covenant. Now we'll be talking more about that because we use the word covenant like baptismal covenant, etc., etc. But you know, until you get in the Psalms, I don't think you know how serious to take covenant relationship. And the covenant relationship for the psalmist is everything. And that is a background that you have to sense, otherwise you can misread the Psalms. And the basis of Israel's prayer life is covenant. And when you talk about covenant, you're talking about Yahweh. Talking about Yahweh. Let's get red up here, huh? We get Yahweh. Yahweh is, King James translates that Jehovah. We don't know how it's pronounced because the Hebrew never pronounced the name of God, as maybe some of you know. Did you know that? Some of you say yes, some say no. Yeah, the Hebrew never used the name of God. Thou shalt not take the Lord thy name of the Lord thy God in vain. Well, don't use it. Now that obviously was not keeping the commandment. But anyway, it was one of the ways. They never use the name God. They always use something substituted for it. And Matthew, you know, he's a good Hebrew. You ever notice that in Matthew? He never uses the term kingdom of God. What does he use? Kingdom of heaven, right. He substitutes right away heaven for God. He won't use the name God. Good Hebrew won't do that. He uses the term heaven. But the other writers, like Luke, he'll take the term kingdom of God as he's talking about Jesus. But anyway, Yahweh. So we don't know how it's pronounced. We think Yahweh is close enough to it, and so Yahweh we use today. When you talk about the basis of prayer life, you have to talk about Yahweh, you have to talk about the community, and you have to talk about the individual. So you have a triangle kind of relationship here that you want to keep in mind, because why the prayer life becomes such a challenging thing, and maybe a challenging undertaking, maybe a threatening thing for some, that it presumes that the individual can only react with God when he includes community. And we're going to sense some of that in the Psalms themselves. And I think we get into the Psalms, we begin to realize it's not just me and Jesus kind of a theology. You're certainly drawn into something much bigger. And you got to have all of that in mind. And the Psalms will pull you into all of that and into that kind of relationship. And therefore, the more personal even a prayer becomes, the more individual it becomes, the more it's bound up in the good for community. And it's in this kind of covenant relationship that speaks about needs also of community. We have found in our studies last week an outline, or let's say this is just a structural thing that we're going to use during the week before we get to the Psalms themselves, that I have found helpful. I think that we found pretty helpful last week, and I swiped it from Walter Brueggemann, and I found it helpful as we begin to address the Psalms. We talk about Psalms in three categories. And by the way, anytime you approach the Psalms and you get to a good commentary, they have a structure that helps. And there's different ways of approaching it. And there is no one set of outlines that is it. Remember, the psalmist didn't have our outline, you know. And each one of them has to be taken seriously, maybe, but not taken legalistically. So we put up when I put these up here, you have to be very careful that when we're going to begin to put psalms into certain categories, that we say, no, that psalm is in that category. You have to watch that, because the psalms don't stay in our little boxes. They don't stay that way. They float, because you're not going to put God in the box either, and so on. But nevertheless, this helps us a little bit, and that's why we use these kind of outlines. And I found this to be helpful. He talks about the Psalms as being poems of orientation and Psalms of disorientation and Psalms of new orientation. And the flow of life is in among these kinds of orientations. Because human life consists of, first of all, seasons of well-being. You know, God is in his heavens and all is right with the world. Everything is in its place. Gee, isn't it neat? It's a beautiful day. You know, that kind of a feeling. And it articulates really the goodness, the coherence, the reliability of God, the reliability of the created order. You know, we feel it maybe up here at Holden, I don't know, some of us may or may not, but you come out here today, what a beautiful day, you know, and everything seems, you know, God is in his heavens, all is right with the world, and I feel great today. Our the season of well-being, and certainly that speaks to a season of life that we all experience at least some point, and hopefully up here at Holden we'll have a lot of this. But if we want to be honest, we say, wait a minute, all of life doesn't fall in the seasons of well-being. And the fact is, human life consists of seasons of a lot of anguish and a lot of hurt,
seasons, you know, when we experience alienation and suffering, where we feel the effects of, quote, the enemy, times of doubt, times of death, etc. And we fall into these psalms of disorientation, because all of life is disorientated. And these, at this period, we come into what we call the Psalms of Lament. The Psalms of Lament. As I've already indicated before, that there are more Psalms of Lament than any one category of Psalms in the Book of Psalms. Which says something that life really probably isn't, if you had to put it out, at least from the psalmist's point of view, is not all well-being. It becomes really, so much of life is a life in which we experience these pains of life, these hurts, this kind of thing. And then we also come into new orientation, the emphasis on new, where life consists of surprises in our life, and we can be at moments in our life overwhelmed at the gifts of God, and when joy suddenly can break through. We're in despair and joy breaks through. And I call this the surprise of the gospel. I take the gospel and its broad scope as well as its narrow scope. And it's also an affirmation of the sovereignty of God, who again can create new situations. The emphasis upon the new is not a reversal just back to the old. Something new has happened, which means that between here and here, that there has been some kind of divine, we might say, intervention in my life of some kind. And now we can, as we unfold the Psalms this week too, we can put this into, I think we see all of this in the life of Jesus. From here, certainly the disorientation, where you better believe it when you talk, you know, passion and death, theology of the cross, and the new situation and the new orientation certainly becomes resurrection. And we're going to see some of that as we get into the Psalms, so that we begin to look at the Psalms not just from the viewpoint of the psalmist, which I think is primary, and also out of our own experience, which I think is necessary, but also we get the Christological scope of the Psalms. Because if this one, born of Mary, becomes the last word of God for us, you know, Hebrews 1. They spoke to us here. Then that becomes, he becomes the interpretive principle, the Christ, you know, and the Christ event becomes the interpretive principle. Also for looking at the Psalms. And it brings us up to Luther. Good brother Luther would say, the Psalms are not only the way we address God, not only our prayer life in which we approach God, but it's the way that God addresses us in the gospel. Now that's, you know. And so therefore, if you're going to use Luther in the Psalms, you will hear Christ speaking to you. Okay. And the Christ, who also knew these Psalms, not just in his head, but out of his gut. And we'll see some of that too. And very important, this is a very, we're down to, I think that this is a very real approach to the Psalms. All my little notes here. Which, so far, I think that's enough of notes, though, and all that good stuff on the board. I think you say, come on, Meyer, let's get into a psalm. But at least this gives us some kind of a frame of reference which will unfold this week, you see. And maybe you understand why today I did not start with Psalm 23. Because we want to start with psalms today that's going to reflect the psalms of well-being. Well-being. And in the psalms of well-being, we're going to note certain things. You know, you know, we only have five times together this week, you know. And, so when you're a teacher, and I also am a preacher, you know how preachers are, and so forth. You try to get it all in, and really, we don't have to get it all in. All we have to do is just touch a few little things this week, and maybe enough to say, wow, there's so much more there, I have a lot more to learn, and that's what we'll be. But we are going to begin today by talking about sounds of well-being. The sounds of well-being can be psalms of praise. We'll see that they will usually be called creation psalms because they'll touch on the creation. And we have to see how and why the psalmist looks at the creation the way he or she does. Okay? And number two, we will also see that it sees, not only, it'll see creation in one hand and the Torah. The Torah is the Hebrew word for law, and the books of the Torah are the books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, okay, the Torah. And that becomes the embodiment, really, of what we can call the prime will of God. Okay? And in the Psalms of Well-being, there is a complete harmony with those who live in the Torah and the orderliness of creation. You see, everything fits. It all goes together. And that feels good. Because anytime we say, I got my life together, we say that phrase, okay, Psalms of Well-being. That's where it's going together. And so we're going to begin today here. Tomorrow is, by the way, just to give you some of the, I'm doing this, my little outline, especially for those that were here last week, because they're going to say, is it worth coming back? And right away, they're just, it's worth coming back because tomorrow we have Martin Luther. If nothing else, for Marty's sake, I want you here. Now, tomorrow, I'm going to do a study that I did on Luther's commentary on Psalm 2, which is a royal psalm, and we'll discuss that likewise. But I think it'll be a refreshing thing, especially for those that are in the second week thing, of approaching the psalms. They're going to do it via Brother Martin. And you'll not only get into the psalm in an interesting way, you'll also get into Martin Luther a little bit interestingly, too. We'll talk about that tomorrow. And on Wednesday, we'll definitely begin to get disorientation. I don't want to talk too much on that today, but disorientation means when life goes awry. And we didn't touch this last week. One of the things disorientation is also this matter of sin. And we're going to get into penitential psalms. We didn't touch those last week. And then we're also going to, in Psalms of Disorientation, get into communal laments by Friday, which is saying that so much of what happens in our life is not just, quote, our sinfulness. Sometimes it becomes circumstantial, you know? Circumstantial means, you know, why me, Lord, type of thing. And we'll see how the psalmists handle those situations. And they have more of those situations than not. Circumstantial means the enemy got me, or, you know, why here, Lord? And see how the psalmist addresses that. We talked about the phrase, the wintry landscape of life. You know, in winter, and it's cold, and nothing's growing. And you're on the edge out there, and they're out there in the snows and the bleakness. Do you ever feel that in life? Where's God? Okay, the psalmist will take us right out there to the wintry edge. And we'll see how the encounter is out there on the cold, not the warm center. That's the bleakness out there. And see that it's a legitimate place, by the way, to be as a Christian. You don't have to feel guilty being out there. Okay? Because then you say, what's wrong with me? Why out there in the warm fire? That's where it is. The Psalms are very realistic. And then new orientation means, hey, God creates new things. He's full of surprises. It's the word grace. It's the word grace in our lives. Okay. Meyer, let's get into a Psalm 33. Would you turn to 33, please? And we'll see how this goes today. Thank you for listening to this rather laborious introduction. I hope that'll be helpful for the rest of the week. I'd like to have us read this, and anybody can read, and have somebody. We should sing the psalm, I know, but we're going to read it. And I'd like to have somebody read the first five verses, please. Anybody that's moved by the Spirit, just read.
Sing joyfully to the Lord, you righteous. It is fitting for the upright to praise Him. Praise the Lord with the harp. Make music to Him on the 10-string lyre. Sing to Him a new song, play skillfully and shout for joy. For the word of the Lord is right and true. He is faithful in all He does. The Lord loves righteousness and justice. The earth is full of His unfailing love.
What translation do you have?
New International.
New International, okay. I operate, by the way, out of an RSV. And why I operate an RSV is that there are many translations in the market, and I think the New International may be even a better translation. But I do it only because I bought this Bible. back. I bought this Bible back in about in the early 60s when I began teaching the Bethel Bible series. And at that time, they were selling, Nelson was selling their Bibles, the wide margin Bibles, you know. And I bought this Bible, the old hardbacks, and I've used that for my Bethel Bible series. And the wide margin, you always write in, right?
Right.
And so on. So I began scribbling in my Bible, you know, and underlining and scribbling. And then that cover fell off, and so I had it rebound. And then I continued because I had some notes in here. And we always like to feel smart when we're lecturing. I can look good. See? And then I had some more. And then, of course, that binding fell off, and I had it bound again. And so then, finally, I've had it. This is the third. This one now is a real leather binding. It cost me about $30-$40 to have it rebound. It cost me $6 to buy it originally. And being a conservative. No, after a while, I tell you, I was making a hospital call out there in the San Fernando Valley one day, I have a 65 Beetle, okay? 65 Beetle, and it's in perfect shape, you know, crap around, it's plenty good to get around. And it was stolen on me several years ago, you know, because they're hot items. And anybody can steal a bunk, you know, anybody can start those things. And we came out of a restaurant one night, it was gone, you know, one of those things. I got it back. They found it in East L.A., out of gas. They took my communion kit, but they left their jacket. Anyway, I know, and I'm so particular about locking my car and, you know, all that stuff. And you get anything stolen like that, and anyway, I left at the hospital, I couldn't find my car. And right away, it's stolen again, because, you know, it's a hot item. Jesus died. And the first thing I said, bang, I left my Bible in that car. The first thing, because, you know, this, I tell you, I wrote in this Bible, you know, the first thing, and I usually don't keep it in the car because this is my working Bible, I don't take it with me. It just so happened I was going to the office type of deal, it was there. I said, oh, Lord, the first thing I thought of, not was my Beetle, was this Bible, because they have so many notes in it, you know. I found the car, it was on the other side of the lot. I tell you, I usually never, people say, come on, can I find my car? I never make that mistake, never. I always, any place, I know where I leave my car, see. But after a while, I retraced my whole steps because I was so upset with myself, and I figured out then how I made the mistake. But I'll tell you, the book was gone. And that's why I operate an RSV. You see, because it just so happens that's what I got. I appreciate your New English Bible. Psalm 33, we open up the first five verses. Let's continue with the psalm, Richard. Okay, let's read verses 6 to 9, somebody. These are sections, by the way, that have purpose. And we'll go back and talk about the psalm and not about VW. Psalm, verses 6 to 7, please.
The Lord created the heavens by his command, the sun, moon, and stars by his spoken word. He gathered all the seas into one place. He brought up the ocean depths in storerooms. Have reverence for the Lord, all the earth. Honor him, all peoples of the world. When he spoke, the world was created. At his command, everything appeared.
Okay, verse 10. That was interpretive translation. You'll find out that some of us have freer translations, which are interpretive. Others have more literal translations. And it's good that we can share this way. Okay, I'd like to have this verse 10 through 17, somebody.
The Lord foils the plans of the nations. He thwarts the purposes of the peoples. But the plans of the Lord stand firm forever, the purposes of his heart through all generations. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people he chose for his inheritance. From heaven the Lord looks down and sees all mankind. From his dwelling place he watches all who live on earth. He who forms the hearts of all, who considers everything they do. No king is saved by the size of his army. No warrior escapes by his great strength. A horse is a vain hope for deliverance. Despite all its great strength, it cannot save.
That's interesting. Verses 18 to 22 conclude this psalm.
Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his steadfast love, that he may deliver their soul from death,
and keep them alive in famine. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and shield. Yea, our heart is glad in him, as we trust in his holy name. Let thy steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us, even as we hope in thee.
Let's just take a look at the psalm in sections, and I'll make a few comments. And then, by the way, and the group from last week knows that you can interrupt at any time. And last week the group began to do that, and that's very permissible. In fact, I encourage it. You know, just interrupt. But that we will come back, and you may have some thoughts too to share. And those are always coveted because you usually speak out of experiential things that really reach home. And so share what you want to share. But just a few comments, just to get prime the pump a little bit on this psalm as we try to understand it. I said this is a psalm that comes out of what we call the seasons of orientation. It's a song of orientation, because certainly as we read this, God is certainly in his heavens. And for the psalmist, for the believer, all is right in the world because everything is well ordered, you know. And it's an easy psalm to read. And what's interesting in the psalm is in the first five verses, we have some of the hymnic structure of the Hebrew hymnic structure. And I think we just take a look at it because it's repeated in the psalms. In the first three verses, we have a summons to praise. And in the next two verses, we have reason for the praise. We just want to take a look at that, because that is something you find often in the, quote, hymns. You have the summons, and then you have the rationale, why we should. And what the psalmist is doing, he's singing a new song about a new world. A new song about a new world, and it's the world that God is in the process of creating. In the process of creating. For the Hebrew, God just didn't create once and then forgot it. God's creator is always in the creating business. And so you have a new song here about a new creation, or a new world, we might say. And the new world isn't something that's heaven out there. It's right now in process. We want to see that the Hebrew is a very now kind of person. Thoughts about eternity out there are foreign to the Hebrew. He's this side of the grave thinker, okay? And we're going to discover why. And also, see how he deals with God, this side. And I think it'll be very pragmatic for us. Very helpful for us. Because sometimes we can get otherworldly in our theology. The psalmist is not otherworldly. He's very this-worldly. You say, well, this-worldly means he's not as spiritual as I am. Just wait a minute. When you get into the psalms, we'll see who's spiritual. Okay? Please, give the psalmist a chance here. But at any rate, rejoice in the Lord, O you righteous. Praise. Now look at, there's five imperatives. Rejoice, praise, make melody, sing, play. These are all imperatives. All imperatives. The summons, because, and who is being summoned here? The righteous. Now the righteous are not people who are just goody-goodies. Don't get that one. You know, we always say the righteous are the good ones. I hope that they're good. That isn't what is meant here. The righteous are really those who keep the Torah, which could be good, but I mean, they really take the Torah seriously. The Torah becomes their way of life. On it they meditate day and night, Psalm 1 kind of thing, which is also a psalm of orientation. But they're also ones that they are the ones who belong to Yahweh's well-orientated world. Not only are they related to the Torah, they're related to the well-orientated world of Yahweh. These two things are always in balance. And therefore, the righteous are the ones who also read creation correctly, because they discern in its good order the loyalty of Yahweh. The loyalty of Yahweh, the faithfulness of Yahweh. And therefore, they can live hope-filled lives. And we'll see at the end of the psalm that they are the ones who can hope in the Lord. Okay? They're the ones that can hope in the Lord. And not to read creation correctly, you become part of the hopeless. And you're not able to trust. Okay? So we begin to see that the created order and the Torah, all these things that fit together in Hebrew thought. And right away, you're summoned
I mean, you're summoned. You're not saying, would you please? These are imperatives. And the righteous are summoned to praise and to sing and make melody unto the Lord. We'll add dancing on that too. Now look at the next two verses, 4 and 5. The reasons for praise. The reason for praise is that is the character of Yahweh. Because the word of the Lord is upright and all his work is done. Notice, faithfulness, righteous and justice, by the way, are, at this point, we're going to use them in a together words. And the word steadfast love. Steadfast love. The reason for praise goes back in the character of Yahweh. And these are three of his chief characteristics. His faithfulness, his righteous justice, and his steadfast love. And these are covenantal terms. They are also part of the creedal formulation that comes out of the people. You go back in the book of Exodus. And the God is merciful and faithful, full of steadfast love to the third and fourth generation, right? That's a creedal statement. And so right away we find that as we give the reasons for giving the praise, the right to give praise, rests in the character of Yahweh. And so that the new song that sings about the new world rests, you see, in the whole character of what Yahweh is. These whole things fit together. Then the next few verses, as we look at that, we get to another section, and there's a reflection on Yahweh's word. It's a very powerful word. The word of the Lord, the heavens were made. It's a powerful word. The speech of Yahweh is powerful speech. And we're going to note, too, that there's a relationship between creator and creation. But we'll also see that the creator is never bound to his creation in the sense that in some pantheistic way. He's always free from it. But the same thing is, he always is attentive to it. There is that kind of relationship. We might say the relationship of steadfast love. But he's never bound by it. In other words, he's not controlled by it. It's also important, I think, as we talk about God and creation. And the whole earth is called in to fear the Lord. As we stand in awe of him, as Luther would say, we fear and love God. And so many times we in our Western culture say, see, I don't like that word fear. I just want to love God. The psalmist says, you'll never know God unless you begin to fear him. So the psalmist says. Now, you can argue with the psalmist. Don't argue with me. But Luther picks that up, we fear and love God. Of course, it's a word of awe, but it can be a fearsome awe, the one that you're dealing with. And the Lord is not only has word of power, he's also the God of history. He's the God of history because he brings the counsel of nations to naught. Okay, one little thing that's interesting. To show you relationship, I was talking of creature and creator. Verse 7, you had a free translation there, but the literal translation is, he gathered the waters of the sea as in a bottle. Now you talk about taking all the waters of the ocean. Take all the waters of the ocean, and God fills up his Coke bottle with it. I mean, it does show you a little bit about relationships, you know. You know, the Creator, he fills up his Coke bottle with all the ocean, you know, all the waters. Okay. I mean, the concrete imagery of the Hebrew poet, you know. You don't have to get, you know, wow, you know, that kind of awesomeness. I just throw that in. Okay, but in verse 10, we have the Lord of history. And blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, verse 12, as people whom he has chosen as his heritage. There's a conclusion, you see, that's being drawn about being God's people. God's people over against those who do not know the Lord. But the people who can draw that conclusion are those people he has chosen. Again, they are the ones who know the orderliness of created order. They live in that. They can trust that all is right in the world. Verse 13. And the Lord looks down from heaven. He sees all the sons of men. He sees humanity from that particular perspective. And again, the Lord is free, utterly free from the world, but he's utterly attentive to it. Utterly attentive to it. And he's the one who looks down so that he's looking down on people who put their their faith in wrong things. I don't know if you want to discuss this later, but it's interesting. I don't know how you would put this into contemporary. If the psalmist, you know, came out of our 20th century American setting, how he would say the king is not saved by his great army, a warrior is not delivered by his great strength. I think that's an interesting little theme. I don't know if Americans believe that. I think we are, but we do believe we're saved by our strength. The number of tanks we have, the number of missile heads we have. I think, really, we're in some real interesting little thinking from the psalmist's point of view over against the way we usually think. The war horse is vain for the hope of victory. I don't know if we believe that. I think we say, wait a minute, you know. We like the war horse. Okay, but anyway, the Lord looks down from the heavens. And what the Hebrew is saying, from the psalm orientation then, from when God is in heaven's all right with the world, he is the one, finally, who is Savior. And then verses 18 and following there, as the psalmist is wrapping this up, behold becomes a word now of conclusion. The eye of the Lord is upon those who fear him, on those who hope. Remember that word hope, in his steadfast love. Because they have a basis for hope. The eye of the Lord, you know, I was in a house once that had a picture on the wall, which was the eye of God. You ever see those? I saw those. I says, gee, what's that eye? What's that? That's God. He's looking at us. I says, well, okay. And I said, I never saw that before. I mean, I never saw just that picture before. And I says, well, I said, that's interesting. And you know, it really was spooking me out. The eye of the Lord. You know what it reminded me of? It reminds me, if you've ever been in Las Vegas, and of course you people never go there, but anyway, the last time I was in Las Vegas, well actually I was up in Lake Tahoe a few weeks ago, vacationing, and of course it's California, you go to Nevada, because you go to Nevada, right away you're in the casinos, you know? Go across this side of the line, you know, you're in something else. But anyway, you go in these casinos, and they always have these beautiful mirrors on the ceiling. Those mirrors, of course, we all know are one-way mirrors. You better believe it. They have spotters up there by you don't know how many. Well, they're dealing with so much money down there, it's going so fast. The eyes are upon you. And the eye of God is watching you. Now, that's not what it means here in the psalm. Is what I'm trying to drive at. That's not what it means. And I'm just saying, that's why I interpreted that at one time in my life. Which really said more about my insecurities or my guilt or something like what God is saying to me. That's not what the psalmist is saying, you know. He is saying, hey, you know, the eyes upon the sparrow and the eyes also on me, which means he looks after me. It's a very personal thing. It's a positive thing in the psalm. It's not a negative thing. It's not law, it's gospel, okay? Give the psalmist a break at this point. You know, he says, give me a break at this point, Richard. The eye of the Lord, what it means here is watchful care. That's what it means in the psalm here. So when you read it, please read it from that perspective and not from the idea that God is watching you, you know. Which, you know, we give that to the kids once in a while. You know, we raise kids, watch out, God is looking at them. Sheesh. No, the eye of the Lord is upon us, which means that God is, it's a very personal thing and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful, positive statement. And that's why we hope. That's why we hope in his steadfast love. Not because he's sort of sneaking up and looking at us through a one-way, you know, mirror type of thing. But he really has us in his concern and love. That he may deliver our soul from death and keep them alive in famine. Did you get that? One of the great threats is famine. It's not our threat, not in America. It was a threat, a very real threat in that world at that time. The same is still a real threat in Africa today. Famine. Very real threat. And it's something that they related always with death. Our soul waits for the Lord. This word wait. We can come back there again. You know, we wait on the Lord because there's deliverance from real worldly danger. He's our help and our shield. Our heart is glad in him because we trust in his holy name. The name of God is at stake. And we'll see later on in the Psalms of Lament, in this orientation, that the psalmist will lay it upon God, that his name is at stake, and therefore he better deliver. Yes, who is right? Wait a minute, right? Pardon me, the most of last week. It's in the book.
Don't look at me. It's very embarrassing. I mean, you talk about, you can, don't have to come back the rest of this week again, but you're going to get that. The psalmist will say, God, your name is at stake, you better deliver. I don't know if you talk to God like that, but the psalmist does. And we'll have to say why. Wait a minute. Don't get the idea that the psalmist is just brash or arrogant or that kind of thing. That's not the case. We're going to get into a kind of relationship that is maybe, at least for me, has been a new kind of approach and relationship with God, which is really powerful. And the psalmist had that. So we'll get into that. Well, I'm saying the name of God is big. Name of God is big. Yahweh. When God comes to Moses, you know, out there, the burning bush, he says, I'm going to give you what? What does he give to him? His name. My name is Yahweh. I am. When you go before Pharaoh, tell him who sent you. I am sent you. I'd rather have the wild horse than a few tanks in mine, you know, really. I mean, no, I'm not trying to be funny. I mean, really, when you think back, you say, hey, what kind of an asinine soul, you know, just with the name. The I am sent me. To Ramses II, by the way. You don't know, yeah, read Ramses II. Read that. Read no Ramses II. The I am sent me. That's all you need. My name. No wonder Moses said, send Aaron, you know. He can talk better. Talk better. You go first, man. No, but the name of God, the name. And the name is Yahweh. He says, Abraham, your father's name to me is Adonai. Adonai. Now you know me as Yahweh. It's a redemptive name. And they'll experience that redemptive name to the Red Sea. That's what my name does. It redeems. You were as good as dead. I give you a resurrection. That's my name. Okay? So we're dealing with the name of God. We're not just saying, you know, a catechism class, what are the names of God? You know, that is not what is being spoken of here. The name here is all in all. And so, because we trust in your holy name, they really trust in that name. And they'll hold God to his name. They're going to hold him to that. That takes not only guts, it takes faith, by the way. Okay? All right. And so, let thy steadfast love, O Lord. Steadfast love is one Hebrew word. We don't know how to translate it. Mercy is the word that's often used in the King James. It's a word of, it's a covenant term, unconditional love, grace. It's big. Even as we hope in thee, the one who, and why do we hope in him? Because he's faithful. That's why. Our hope isn't, gee, you ought to wish in something. You know, people say, well, you might as well believe in God. You know, Jerry, you've heard that. You know, we might as well believe. You believe in God? Yeah, that's good. I think it's good you believe in God. That's not what it's saying is your hope is in God, not because you have wishful thinking. It's because there you have the rock, the steadfast love. And on that now, you have hope. Hope means you have a future. Count on. That's what the psalmist is saying. So much for this Psalm 33, for my comments and so forth. Any reactions in anybody? Any feelings go through you? It's a psalm again, well-being, you know. It's a beautiful psalm. It fits Holden maybe for many of us, you know. Everything is in its order. Even the deer let their fawn come in here because they feel the village is safer for their fawns in the wilds. I kid thee not. This is where they have their fawns, right here. Not out there. And their mothers, they'll go off in the woods and, you know, eat whatever they, you know, the fawns, and they leave their fawns here because they trust us. Weird. In a way, I mean, some of that's been new for me. It's just really, really awesome thing. Because here, the deer are operating very much out of this. God is in his heavens and all right is in the world. Everything can be trusted. Even those two-footed creatures walking around. Yeah, there's some, the deer is very much a symbol of this. You know. Oh, they're a little hesitant, but they learn. Oh, wait a minute. Yes.
I'm just thinking that even when things are disoriented, that solid is still remains there.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. We're going to get into Psalms of Disorientation. And I know we'll get Psalm 88, the great psalm where there's no hope. That's a bomb. We said the last to show you the wintry landscapes in their extreme, the psalmist will walk there.
And so many times we're in the disorientation, the Psalms of Lament are the Psalms that we suddenly can identify with. But that being said, what you just said is very important. So many times people, when their whole life is apart and everything is hurting, and the kids, you know, have done this, and here you have the widow, that type of experience, you know, they'll go back and the psalm that they'll recite is this one. Why? Because it becomes a psalm and says, that's the way it ought to be, or that's the way it can be, you know, that kind of psalm. Very much so. So again, I'm glad you said that. We don't want to take these psalms and say, you know, what period of life you're in, or the psalm will say. We're not saying that in this class at all. They all fit at how they fit us at that moment. It was a good comment. In this psalm, anything come to mind in this psalm? Anything you want to react to? Yeah, go on.
The Jews...
Go ahead.
Luther really had the spirit of the psalmist in terms of holding God to his word. When Melanchthon was sick, and Luther prayed, and he said, I rubbed God's promises in his ears. Melanchthon was spared, and some feel, well, maybe Luther prayed too hard, and it might have been better if he had prayed earlier, but that was the spirit that he had.
Did you hear that? We're going to talk more about Luther tomorrow. Now, I suggest, and I don't know, I know in this group that there's some Old Testament scholars that will pop up, you know, from the university or something. And also, I know out here, I respect that, because out here, there's a lot of stuff out here that we've got to listen to in each other. I'm just a leader that's just trying to get us started. And some of us will be more into Luther than others. But I maintain that Luther... Not only, you know, Psalms was the first book he lectured on. We'll get into this tomorrow a little bit. And I will suggest that Luther was very influenced by Hebrew thought, because he took the chair of Old Testament before he did anything in New Testament. And not only did he exposit the Psalms, I think the Psalms began to exposit him. And he does. He thinks concretely. He thinks Hebraically. And I think that's one reason what made him so real to the people. I'll rub the promise of God right in his ear. You know, that you talk about bold praying. But that's it, and that's Hebrew, very much so. Yeah. Pardon me, we had one person here first before you.
Well, I just wanted to ask with regard to the Hebrew not saying the word God, is that still true among the Orthodox Jews today?
Anybody? I really, you know what, I have my Jewish rabbi friends being not Orthodox, but being Restoration or Reformed, they're in the Restoration movement, they use the name God, as far as I'm sure, rather freely. But I would think that the Orthodox, especially the ascetic Jew and so forth, would still avert that. I would just guess that. Pardon me.
I just read a book, The Sabbath Laws, last week, and they'll print one letter or two letters and skip some.
Okay, thank you. No, really. I love this place. I love this place because there's so much resource that comes out all over the place here. And that's what makes it fun, by the way, to be here. You know. Did you hear that? That they'll use one or two letters, but not all of it. Because that's respect. And by the way, you know, you grow up a little bit over the years. I used to, when I first heard about the Jews still doing that, you know, kind of thing, and say, oh, how dumb. But then I begin to wonder, you know, at least they have respect for the name, which some of us can learn a little more of.
Pardon me, there's a hand over here, and we'll bounce over there. Yeah.
A further comment on this idea of holding God to his name or his promise comes to my mind, and I think Helmut Thielke was paraphrasing Luther in one of his sermons or books when he said, throw the sack of God's promises at his feet and he will not step over it.
Yeah, that's Thielke. That's Thielke, right. That's right, that's Thielke. Yes, one of his quotes. And it takes, by the way, a lot of guts to do that, and a lot of faith guts. But you're just saying there, and it's a kind of a divine, it's a kind of encounter with the divine that's both scary in one sense, but it's exactly what the psalmist is at. Yeah, yeah. Maybe, and I think we can learn from that. We had one more comment here. Yeah.
In response to this gentleman's question, the I was in a synagogue some years ago, and I made a particular note of the way they read. And whenever they came to the word Yahweh, they never ever said it. They always said Adonai.
Adonai, is that right? Adonai, by the way, is the other name for God. Adonai means literally the God of the mountains, I believe, but it means the Almighty One. And often the word God comes in that way. That's right. So they would say the word Yahweh out. Yahweh again is the personal name given to Israel. You know, it's like people call me Dick. You know, because that says, hey, we have a relationship. We can use a first name kind of thing. Yahweh in this sense, without taking it, it's sort of the first name, the relationship name. Yeah.
I'm wondering about your words up there that give us a background, and I sure you have a fine sense with your description of what it's referring to. I'm wondering, most often, is it referring to the individual or to the environment in which the individual finds himself? I can see a person being in a world that seems disoriented, and still the individual is oriented. Mm-hmm. Is there a... Mm-hmm.
I think you're saying, yeah, I say yes to what you're experiencing there. Again, yes, you can be a disoriented world, and you can very much feel over here, you know, very much as a faith statement. At the same time, though, as we get into the Psalms more, we'll see they're not so much individualistic expressions as expressions of community, which the community, by the way, in a disorientated world, can also sense this and profess this, you know, that kind of thing. And we do that in worship. We will, together we do a psalm, and that everybody is at that place of the psalm, really. You know, I don't know. Yeah.
I guess I would see Christ is often living in a disoriented world, mm-hmm. but he was always oriented. He always knew where he was going.
But we also see in the Psalms that he also experienced total disorientation. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? That's total disorientation. Everything is disorientated because God is absent. If we take it seriously, if we take it literally, and if we get into that, I'm just saying though, it's true that many a times you have an insight there that when the realm of God moves in the world, I call it the God movement, kingdom, you know, that word, the basileia, tu theou in the Greek, that this movement in the world. And Jesus certainly is the embodiment of that. And we see it. And when he came, he healed, right? He cast out demons because everything had to be back again into that kind of orientation. And notice he deals with created order, which is your body or, you know, your own being. And when Jesus passes through, you know, you have people that are healed. Everything is, you know, God is in his heavens and all is right with the world again. But we also see in Jesus, really, even in this area of healing, something new happening. The problem with the people is they couldn't see the new.